Thank you very much, Lois. That was a very moving talk. I'd like to introduce Dr. Ken Geiser, who's on the faculty of the Department of Work Environment here at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. He's also the director of the Toxics Use Reduction Institute and co-director of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. Dr. Geiser is going to talk with us some about the efforts to roll back right-to-know provisions that we've won that Lois was talking about. And he's someone, along with Lois and quite a few other people, who, as they say, spent 9 months of their lives in 1985 and 1986 trying to get legislation and succeeding for community right-to-know. So, Ken?
Thanks a lot, Craig. I'm an old enough organizer to know that one of the things you never do on a podium like this is follow Lois Gibbs. I actually pleaded that I be the warm-up act for this so that we could build toward Lois, but actually Lois, I think as you can see, has once again sort of codified the whole question about risk and community and the kinds of differences between those who actually suffer and stand for safety and security in the society and those who purport risk and danger. What I want to do is talk a little bit about right to know. Lois mentioned this, and I just want to update people a little on what's going on at the moment. It's a very interesting time for people like ourselves who for many years have struggled to try to bring to the attention of government officials and corporate officials the conditions that take place in industrial facilities that where dangerous and lethal and toxic materials are stored and used. And that over and over again, our advocacy has been around the question of safety and the question around security. And that we've asked that the government and corporate policies try to guarantee a safer system of production such that our families and communities are safe. So it's a bit surprising lately to see in the last month and a half that the chemical industry and the chemical industry's trade group is in Congress at this point arguing that its facilities are not safe, that they are dangerous. In fact, they're quite vulnerable facilities. They're vulnerable to terrorists and vulnerable to terrorist attack. And the proper way to address this is to do essentially what the government did for the airline industry, which is provide an enormous new source of funding to, quote, harden the chemical industry facilities, put up larger fences, increase the number of guards at the facilities, do all kinds of investigations of employees to find out criminal backgrounds, to basically attempt in every other way than the most obvious way to reduce the risks of these facilities. And the most obvious way is obviously to change the production system itself. So I think it's an interesting time. This is a struggle going on right now in budget issues and some of the appropriation committees. But it's interesting to take a look back at how we've found the table so turned on who's saying that the chemical facilities are dangerous and vulnerable, because that was always our line. And I think it's important to recognize, as Lois did, that the earliest formation, the earliest demands in this country for right to know information about chemical hazards in the workplace and in the facilities, industrial facilities, came from workers, came from working people and their trade unions who struggled during the early part of the 1980s to try to move forward what were known at that point as worker right to know legislation. And in many ways, I think we can be pleased that the Hazard Communication Standard, which became the sort of unified national OSHA standard for guaranteeing that workers do have some access to that information, was a result of the many grassroots efforts in working places and in communities to try to create information for workers. In 1984, the tragedy at Bhopal caught the attention of the world and taught us how necessary it was to provide information to communities as well as workers. And in the years that followed that, in the write-up, the amendments to the Superfund Reauthorization Act, Title III was added, the Emergency Response and Community Right to Know provisions, which for the first time also guaranteed that firms would have to report to the public on the kinds of toxic materials that they released from those facilities into the public air and waterways and land. And for many of you who've worked with the Toxics Release Inventory, you know what a valuable tool this has been and how important it's been, not only at our own advocacy, but also in creating the incentives that Lois mentioned for moving companies to try to take better responsibility for the chemicals that they release from their facilities. Now, release is one thing, use is another. Risk, hazard, during accidents is another. And in 1990, we won another additional piece of the Right to Know puzzle, which was in the amendments to the Clean Air Act in 1990, we won provisions that would require that thousands of chemical processing facilities in the country would have to create something called risk management plans, which were plans that would identify the hazards in their facilities and create emergency response provisions for what would take place in the case of those hazards. But what was particularly useful in there was something called the offsite consequences assessments. And that was that the regulations required that the chemical companies, hundreds of them at this point, needed to create scenarios on what would be the most dramatic, worst-case conditions that would take place if there was an explosion or an accident at the facilities. And these things, these became known as the worst-case scenarios, were to be provided to the public, were to be provided to the neighborhoods, so that people living near the chemical processing facilities would not only know that they were in a zone of endangerment during an accident, such as the Bhopal accident, but also that emergency responders and others could pull people together to build a reliable system for responding in those kinds of cases. And then we saw a resistance begin to build. And the resistance first came from the chemical industries, the facility owners and managers themselves, who basically argued that this information put out in the public would not only be quite frightening to the public, unnecessarily so, but also could fall into the wrong hands and could be used as an invitation to various kinds of terrorist activities. And to their clever benefit, what they did is they enlisted the FBI as an ally in this. And with the aid of the FBI, they put a great deal of pressure on the EPA to not release the information in the worst-case scenarios. And the grassroots and environmental communities fought back and struggled, and there was eventually achieved a compromise, which is that while the risk management plans and summaries would be made available on the Internet, that the worst-case scenarios would be only available in hard copy in a very small number of libraries on something called a read-only basis, no photocopying, please, such that people might be able to get this information, but it would be through very constrained activities. So then, in September, we had the tragic accidents in Pennsylvania, Washington, and New York. And what the September 11th incidents did to Right to Know was an immediate hysterical reaction. And the first thing that the EPA did within 2 weeks after September 11th was to shut down all of the information, the thousands and thousands of pages on the Internet, on the risk management plans. In addition, the Department of Transportation closed down all of its Internet sites on the pipelines, on the fuel pipelines around the country and fuel storage facilities. The USGS shut down all of its information on drinking water supplies, on where the reservoirs were and what their supply rates were to the various communities. The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry pulled its 1999 study known as Industrial Chemicals and Terrorism, a study that really anticipated what might happen at these facilities were they attacked by by terrorists. And then we began to see action at the states as well. I watched from the point of view of state professionals, friends of mine, who watched as Pennsylvania shut down all of its information around water supplies, toxic chemicals. New Jersey, the other state, which has a really a wonderful database on chemical use, sharply curtailed and eventually closed much of its database on toxic chemical use in New Jersey. And even the NGOs were not immune. The U.S. PIRG actually withdrew its recent publication on risks at fertilizer plants under a great deal of pressure from the government itself. So in the wake of the September 11th tragedies, what we saw was an enormous move to try to close down one of the big victories that we in the environmental and citizen movements had achieved over a 20-year period, which was getting information available to the public about chemical hazards at industrial facilities. So I wasn't particularly surprised when I got the phone call myself. As a director of the Toxics Use Reduction Institute, we have a database. We put up data on the some 500 facilities in Massachusetts that use toxic chemicals in the state in quantities over 10,000 pounds or more. And that database is available to community people to find out what chemicals are used, not just released, but used in the facilities in their neighborhoods and communities. And it has been an enormously valuable database. I thought it was kind of amusing the way the call came to me. The call came from the regulatory division, the Department of Environmental Protection, and it turned out that it had come about because the lawyers at the DEP had decided that they should shut down the various databases as New Jersey had that might fall into the wrong hands. And so they had found that we had this toxic use reduction database, so they decided they would close down the DEP's database. And then they discovered that the DEP did not own the database, that the database was owned by the institute at the university. And so there was a sort of subtle call I got rather than a commanding call, which was, many states are closing down their databases. We're wondering what you're going to do about yours, is the way it got framed to me. My response was pretty quick, and I said, look, we're a university. Our job is education and information, and that's what we're in the business of, and we aren't shutting down this database. That created quite a bit of a... quite a bit of a stir, as you might guess, because I'm a nice guy and everybody kind of likes to get along with me and I don't get hard very often. But it came down to was a whole bunch of negotiations with me, and the only thing we've actually agreed to is that we would ask people to identify themselves when they use the database, which I'm not particularly happy about. But on the other hand, the information is up, it's on the web, it's usable, and it is still there. Now, I think that the lessons here are important, and that is that I think the events of September 11th have once again revealed very starkly to us what many of us know, the chemical and other petroleum and other industries know as well and don't like to talk about, which is this very advanced industrial society is built on highly lethal, hazardous, and poisonous chemicals. And that the products and services that we enjoy in our economy, many are produced using dangerous materials that set workers at risk and set communities at risk. Whether it's chlorine used in disinfecting water supplies, and by the way, when we did a little look at using our database to try to identify, well, what highly explosive chemicals are being stored at facilities around Massachusetts, what are the largest amounts of those? We found that chlorine was the largest amount. And it's used mostly for wastewater disinfection and drinking water disinfection. And there are large tanks of it around, which are potential sites for mischievous behavior. But it's not just chlorine. Chlorine is, of course, one. It's uranium in nuclear energy facilities. It's pesticides in pesticide in agricultural facilities stored in large tanks. It's cyanide stored for plating and plastics manufacturing. Many different operations store highly explosive, inflammable, and dangerous chemicals on their facilities. It is critical to understand that we need to attend to that, that we need to reduce the hazardousness and the potential for risk and threat that comes from these chemical processing facilities. But what is important is that we need to resist the effort to reduce those risks by, quote, hardening the facilities. Building bigger fences, putting in more guard dogs, and checking the criminal records of workers is not going to assure us safe chemical processing. The only way we're going to get to safe chemical processing is to build inherently safe processing facilities. And that means not only reconsidering the production systems, but it means reconsidering the materials themselves. And here's my little plug for a book. I wrote a book on this, so it's recently out, and you're all invited to buy it. It's called Materials Matter, and the argument of the book is essentially that we can use the brilliant ingenuity and capacity and talent and energy of our scientific and technical and popular communities to really move toward a safer system of materials. And only that is going to provide for us not only a set of industrial processes that guarantee us the kind of products and services that we want in our lives without the kind of risks that Lois Gibbs had to fight in Niagara, New York, around the Love Canal facility, and thousands of other families have had to mobilize around. And that workers everywhere in this country and around the world, increasingly around the world, are exposed to. And that consumers are exposed to as we try to consume the products. Only by moving to more inherently safe systems of production, materials that fit better into the natural systems of the planet, and chemicals that are compatible with our own bodies such that we can live successfully and safely with the products that we actually are trying to use and enjoy. That is the mission that we should be about in this next century. This university, the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, an enormous resource of technical talent, is going to be playing a major role in that. I'm proud to say that because of all of the people here, many of you in this room, but all the people that I know and work with here at the university. I am pleased that this university has taken a position to seek as its mission a sustainable region, a sustainable industrial region, and that our chancellor and others have committed us in that direction. And so for Craig and the people here who work within the hazardous waste worker training programs, and for folks who work in my operation, the Toxic Use Reduction Institute, for those who are working in the centers around regional economic social development, and all the many different groups in advanced chemistry and some of the really wonderful things in bioprocessing and biopolymers, etc., I think we hold one of the keys to that vision. So it's great to be able to speak to you. It's great to be on this platform with Lois Gibbs, who's a friend and a colleague I've known for a long time and someone who's really been a great proponent of mobilizing people to demand a better and safer society. Because one of the real pleasures of writing the book was doing the historical section. Because the historical section really taught me that the only true lasting voice for safety and security has been the people of this country. That's who we need to trust. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ken. Let me apologize for the radio station coming through. What I'm told is that the wires for the mics work as antenna for the radio station that's across the street. And apologize for the lack of heat. We're doing our share of not burning fuels. But we've got some time. We've got about 40 minutes, and we really would like to make this a forum. Ken, I don't know how long you can stay. Ken can stay about 10 minutes, but Lois is here for the duration, and hopefully you are also. So we have a mic set up there. If you have a question or a comment or something that you would want to say either to Lois or Ken or to us as a whole, please come up, introduce yourself, and make your comments. Please.
You're right. I guess what I'm thinking about when I say us versus them, it's not the plant manager and it's not the local folks and the local sort of people in the plant, but it's really the boardrooms. You know, it's us versus the boardrooms, and all of us versus the boardrooms. And sometimes it is us versus us, which is something I'm saying we ought to stop doing and figure out how to deal with. But when we were doing the book, I was just telling Ken this because this is terribly embarrassing. But when we were doing the book, Dying from Dioxin, which I happen to have had handed to me this morning, when we did this book, one of the things that we wanted to talk about is that we're not at the gates at the plants protesting, that it's not about the workers in the plants. It's not about the manager of the plant. Or the CEO locally. It's really about us versus who's making the decisions in the boardrooms and what are they making those decisions on and what is their priority, and if their priority is not the same as ours, and they don't drink the same water, those in the boardroom, and they don't sit underneath the same stacks. And they don't suffer in the same fashion that the workers and the communities around there suffer. Most of them that I know live in some very nice place, somewhere at quite a distance away, and drink bottled water that low-income people couldn't afford. I mean, so they really do have a different lifestyle. But I'm thinking about corporate America in the boardroom and the CEOs and not the plants themselves, because that's where the decisions are being made. The plant manager, the plant operator, the rest of them have to follow these orders. And it gets very difficult because many of them are saying they don't want to do it either.